You ready there, Daria? Okay. Hit it. Well, tonight we'll be able to talk about step 12. Having had a spiritual awakening is the result of these steps. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics, parentheses, or anybody else, and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Well, what comes to mind for me right now, actually, is just to let you know that I am going to head off to do a 10-day self-retreat, leaving on Sunday, to practice for myself. And, you hear me talk about retreats a lot, and just want you to know that I am trying to walk my talk. I'm very grateful to be able to have the kind of flexibility in my life to be able to take 10 days and go off, especially 2 days after my taxes were filed. Well, that's a good sign. As I do sometimes, I picked up my own book today to see what I had to say about step 12. Well, you know, it's like looking through your old notebooks or something and remembering something you hadn't thought of. Right? It's not like I carry that book around in my head. But what struck me, I was noticing the part that in step 12 that says breadth of practice. And there's two different headings for breadth of practice. One of them is daily mindfulness, and I think the other one is in all our affairs or something. Let's see what it is. Breadth of practice, all our affairs, and breadth of practice, daily mindfulness. And I was thinking, I thought there was something in here about depth of practice, too. Where's that? And oh, maybe it's back in step 11. Oh, it's in step 11. And it got me thinking, because I like these two ideas of thinking about practice as having breadth, where it's involved in our lives and the many ways that we can bring our spirituality. But also depth, which is where retreats particularly come up, and I'm sure there's other ways we can think of depth, but that's the way that I connect with it when my meditation goes very deep and it goes very still, or things really start to open up on that psychic level, that deep psychic level. So it occurred to me that this was one way of thinking about the relationship between step 11 and step 12, which I'd never thought of before, which was what makes it interesting to me, because I like to have fresh ideas. And this, what seems like kind of a fresh idea to me, is that the role of step 11 is for us to take our spiritual practice deeply. And that's an ongoing thing, the seeking sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact, that there's this ongoing process of improvement. Sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly, but that step 11 is really about that depth of spiritual connection and spiritual practice, spiritual experience. But that then step 12 is about the breadth of our experience, as it talks about practice these principles in all our affairs. So that's something to chew on, if you like. But also, I'll talk a little bit about spiritual awakening, as we had that as a discussion topic before. And someone asked how I defined it. And what occurred to me as I was listening to people share about that is that a spiritual awakening is whatever we want it to be. And we get to define what it is. It's not something you know, like that's a chair. We can kind of all agree that's a chair. Spiritual awakening, it could be, it can take all kinds of forms or non-forms. And that's, I think that's good news. I know that when I first heard about enlightenment, and then, maybe, which I didn't hear the term spiritual awakening until I got sober, but I thought that those meant the same thing. And I think they do in some sense. But what I, when I first heard about enlightenment, what I thought it meant was you get to be high all the time for free. And you don't have to take any drugs or buy anything. So that's what I thought a spiritual awakening was. And so I thought that meant I would always be happy and I wouldn't have any problems. The real delusion of it was that somehow a spiritual awakening was also going to affect my bank account, you know. That kind of delusion. It's just going to fix everything. And well, if I had consciously thought about that, I probably would have been acknowledged that that wasn't true or likely. I don't think it would have occurred to me that a spiritual awakening didn't mean being high all the time or being happy all the time. Or feeling spiritual all the time. Feeling connected, feeling sort of mystical presence all the time. And I would have said that it involved some big, thunderous moment of the burning bush or this enlightenment experience like the Buddha had, which when you read about it, it's kind of strange in a way what they say happened to him that night. But it's not so mystical as we might imagine it to be, and it's not so earth-shattering, except that, you know, the mythology of it. In any case, then that brings me just to maybe the point of talking about what I think a spiritual awakening is now. And the reason I say it's whatever we want it to be is that I realize that the way I define spiritual awakening is that it's something that I'm comfortable with, and it helps me to feel comfortable to have the definition of spiritual awakening that I have. And that is that every one of the steps is a spiritual awakening, first of all. And that spiritual in itself is not some distant or even special state being spiritual. But this idea of practicing these principles in all our affairs is much closer to spirituality to me. Following the precepts, viewing the world with some compassion, viewing myself with some compassion, seeing how I can be of service just by being honest, by being real. I mean, a guy came over to my house today to work on our solar panels. We had to change out the inverter. And one of the things that I do somewhat intentionally is I let people know what I do, because I find that by letting people know, very often it opens a door for them. So by the time he left, he was asking me when my classes were at Spirit Rock, you know. Not because I'm trying to promote my classes, but because I know this is a human being. And, I often tell people, oh, yeah, I'm a recovering alcoholic. You know, I just put that out very quickly because amazingly often that winds up being of service to that person. oh, really? Oh, yeah, I have a friend, or I used to go to AA, or I get, or I'm in a program, or, oh, that, you know, all of us, and you just, and that to me is part of my, in all my affairs, and that to me is part of living my spiritual life. It's not that I'm promoting something or proselytizing. It's just that I've found that if I'm really open and honest and actually take the risk of telling people the truth, that it often leads to benefit for them, and then maybe for me too. It certainly, I walk away from that encounter feeling like I had a connection and an intimate experience with someone, rather than, you know, thanks a lot, here's the money for the, you know, solar panels. You know, it's So I think we do ourselves a disservice when we separate the idea of spirituality from the rest of our lives. To me, the front page of the newspaper is an opportunity to see the failures of not seeing the world through a spiritual vision. That you know, greed, hatred, and delusion are what the news is all about. And I guess that's one of the reasons I don't pay as close attention to the news as I might. So let me talk a little bit about specifically about how I see spiritual awakening happening through the steps. I think that step one may be the most transforming spiritual, may have been the most transforming spiritual event of my life, when I fully realized my powerlessness over alcohol and that I had to change. If there was ever a sudden awakening for me, like, wow, and everything changed, it was that. And it was that day when I stopped drinking and using. And I remember that day very well. I not that I remember what particularly what happened, a little bit about it, but more I just remember the feeling, the weight being lifted. And I know that doesn't happen for everybody, but it happens for a lot of people. And certainly once we turn that corner, there is a real sense of transformation having happened. And most of us at that moment probably would not say, oh, I've had a spiritual awakening. But what else would you call that? What else could you call that but a spiritual awakening? You're awakening to your powerlessness. You're awakening to the suffering. And what makes it distinctive and important is that it's a transformative awakening. This bears a little discussion that at this center we teach insight meditation, which is a translation of the word vipassana. I'm going to give you a little bit of my understanding of how that works, which is not, I don't know that this is the party line. I haven't looked up the party line lately. My experience with this practice is that a lot of insights kind of come at times, some of which are just really interesting. Some of them are kind of, a lot of them are kind of psychological. And then there's like a gradual accumulation of what you might call wisdom or kind of an understanding where I really start to see impermanence and suffering and all that unfolding. But that many of those experiences, you know, many people will go on retreats and, wow, that retreat was really amazing. Many of them don't necessarily have a transforming quality. And what I mean by that, a transforming quality, is that they change the way you live and the way you are and the way you respond and react to the world. A transformative insight, on the other hand, as opposed to just a plain old vanilla insight, is one that once having had that experience and seen that truth, you are changed internally and externally, that your life changes. And that's why I call the experience of step one the one of the most powerful transformative insights of my life. It wasn't just that I saw, oh yeah, I got a drinking problem. It was like, phew, I couldn't drink anymore. You know, what made that decision, I couldn't do it anymore. It was like, no, I don't want that anymore. That was, I mean, what, talk about a psychic change. I mean, I'd wanted to be loaded every day for 20 years. And then one day, I didn't want that anymore. Wow, that's powerful. I mean, who needs the other 11 steps? Well, of course we do, but that really says a lot about the power of that. And when I came to the 12 steps and I looked at the steps and I saw spiritual awakening, I said, oh, these steps, you know, there's no way you're going to get enlightened with these steps. You know, you have to become a Buddhist and practice in the forest for 7 years or whatever. You know, my ideas about what enlightenment was. And so I feel like that initial view is really flipped upside down now. Now I believe you get enlightened with the first step. The second step says we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And I think that's an insight of itself. It's another vision. It's seeing, oh, my ego doesn't work. Some other power, some other connection is going to be required for me to change, for me to grow further, for me to maintain this recovery path. So that was another insight, another awakening. Awakening step three is in making the decision. Wow, I have to make a decision and I have to turn it over. I have to accept the things I can't change. And I have to do my part. But I can't expect to get what I want just by doing my part. I have to then accept what happens. That's another awakening. It's a letting go. And awakening implies a letting go. I think I'm going to make this statement that I don't know if it's true, that every spiritual awakening includes and some are solely made up of a letting go. But I think a spiritual awakening by definition involves letting go of something. So put that aside, make a note of that and check for a while. I'll try to keep track of that too, because I think it's an interesting thought. Step four is a kind of awakening to the mess we've made, the truth of it, really seeing it. Oh, yeah. I mean, we have avoided it for a long time. When we turn and when we write that inventory, searching and fearless moral inventory, it's, whoa, oh, yeah, I did, oh, yeah. You know, there's a lot of awakening that happens in that. For me, step five, sharing the inventory was actually awakening to the lightness of my, I'm thinking of the unbearable lightness of being. It wasn't the lightness of being. It was the lightness of my failings, as heavy as they felt in the fourth step. That's how light they felt when I shared them, and really it was that it was coming to see the lack of uniqueness in my own failings. That was the awakening. I'm not so unique. I'm not so bad. So there was also awakening compassion in that step, because when I awoke, so there was awakening compassion and forgiveness and acceptance of myself. And in that, that awoke in my compassion, awoke my compassion for others as well. Because that's how compassion works. When authentic compassion, I believe, involves seeing our own suffering and failings and realizing that they are no different from the rest of humanity. So it's so that in that state, in that place of compassion, there is compassion for the self and for the other as well. So this is then is an, you know, a pretty broad awakening. Step six is we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. And I guess that I would say that there's, you know, this is, once again, just my riffing on this stuff, okay? And so it's not, this isn't meant to be what you have to believe, but just, you know, to think about this for yourself. Step six might be about awakening to the possibility of change, that I can let go. I can change. These defects of character, which I have seen in the steps in 4 and 5, can be let go of, can change. And that change is going to be set in motion by the intention, being willing. And then step 7 is, you know, doing the work, humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. But since that's all about letting go, then perhaps the awakening of that step is the awakening that happens every time we let go and of a defect of character. And I'm not going to, that's too solid a statement, because I'm not sure that we let go of defects of character like, okay, it's gone, but rather moment by moment as they arise, we see, let go, continue on, oh, here it is again, let go. Here it is again, let go. So part of this awakening is seeing that there is no permanent removing of all our shortcomings. Some shortcomings may be removed permanently. Is that a very strong term? So I put that in quotation marks. But that's not what we can count on. Well, I'm wearing myself out going through all the steps like this. But I guess I have nobody to blame but myself. So I'll try to wrap this up. And just to say that the spiritual awakening of steps 8 and 9, I think, are about awakening to our relationships and what the wounds that have happened in our relationships, and again the possibility of healing, and this whole process, steps 4 through 9, for sure, part of the awakening is seeing that what is going to be required is always going to be our action. For that we have to take the karmic steps to make these changes happen. And certainly step 9 is very clear about that. So I think I'll stop there in terms of this kind of illustration, can I say. But clearly what I'm getting at is something, again, just sort of the flip of the idea that enlightenment is this distant, unreachable experience, and I'm never going to get there, and I'm just going to have to practice and practice, and maybe in many lifetimes I'll get there. And rather, and how that absolves us of a certain responsibility. It lets us off the hook in a way. That if we say, actually, no, it's right here. Is there a big enlightenment? You know, maybe. But there's a spiritual awakening, actually. Are you spiritually awake now in this moment? What's happening? Are you awake to your own heart? Are you awake to your own thoughts and feelings? Are you awake to the possibilities of service in this moment, or of love in this moment, of forgiveness in this moment? When we embrace the idea of spiritual awakening as something that's happening here and now, it then becomes practicing these principles in all our affairs is what our lives are. And this is one of the things that I love about the steps, and it's something that we find in Buddhism as well, which is the idea that there isn't some spiritual life that's separate from our non-spiritual life. Oh, when I go to work, or when I'm with the kids, or when I'm at the ball game, I'm not. You know, that's not my spiritual life. You know, my spiritual life is when I go to Spirit Rock and meditate, when I get up in the morning and pray, when I read a spiritual book, or when I have one of those moments, you know, in nature, or, you know, everything comes together and I feel that whole, I feel God. You know, that's great to have those moments. But we can't depend on special moments for our spiritual condition. And it doesn't mean that we have to, you know, crank out some feeling like it's a really crappy day and like I'm supposed to feel spiritual about this. I got a flat tire. This sucks. You know, but to just say, oh, that's what's happening right now. It sucks right now. Okay. But that's not separate from when it doesn't suck. You know, it's just, all part of this thing, you know, called life. Ajahn Buddhadasa says that, talks about little nirvanas. And he, actually, one of his claims, which I think is very interesting, he says that throughout the day, we have little moments of letting go, where your mind stops for just a moment, you might not notice them, where all the tension kind of goes out, where you're not stressing. And he says, those are very brief moments of touching nirvana. And he says, if we didn't have those, we'd go crazy. That's actually what lets us not go crazy, which maybe explain why so many people are going crazy, because they're not having those. So I want to go back now to the beginning of the step and work through it a little bit again. We've certainly talked enough about spiritual awakening, but the key, in terms of how this step is structured, I think there's an elegance to it that is purposeful. And that is that having the phrase that follows having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps is we tried to carry this message to alcoholics. So, you know, as I say, bracket, whatever, you know, other addict you want to put in the parentheses, but I think the larger sense of it is really to be of service in the world, to help people. So whether we do it, whether we think of that as the smaller idea of just I'm going to help alcoholics, or I'm just going to help addicts, or people in Al-Anon, or I'm going to just open my heart and try to be more of service in the world. The connection is that when we have a spiritual awakening, it's not for us. The idea that I'm going to get enlightened and then I'm going to feel good, I'm going to have bliss, I'm going to be happy, that's a very ego-centered idea. And it's not a spiritual idea. And it's not an idea that occurs to someone who's had a spiritual awakening. Not that it doesn't occur to them from time to time, but that's not how that works. You know, that's not where we go with our spiritual awakening. And this is exactly the story of the Buddha. And the Buddha struggled for years. 7 years, he left his family. He went off, lived an ascetic life, almost killed himself, almost starved himself to death, all these crazy practices he was doing. Very alcoholic, as I've said, you know, anorexic, and, all, you know, he was obviously, you know, if anybody gave him a drink, he probably just would have gone off. You know. Finally, he sits down. He has this breakthrough. And he's sitting there, and the story, it's really, it's funny the way they write the story, because it really does sound like a recovery story in a way. It's because his first thought is, like, nobody's going to get this. This is just way, You know, and if I try to go out and teach this, it's just going to be annoying because people aren't going to get it. I'm just going to get frustrated. I'm just going to hang and enjoy it, because he could, right? He's enlightened. I mean, he was really enlightened. We're not just talking, you know, first step enlightenment. We're talking, you know, just whatever psychic change is, he had it big time. So he's sitting there, and my interpretation, once again, of this moment is he's showing a little arrogance, right? It's like, nobody's going to get this. I'm like way beyond all those people, losers, you know. And so in the story, a god comes to him. One of the Brahma gods comes down, or comes from the Brahma heavens. He says, dude, there's some people who will get it. He said, who are you calling dude? That's not quite the language of it. But the phrase is, there are some with just a little dust in their eyes. It's a beautiful phrase. And it really was, to me, a little bit pulling the rug out from under the Buddha's arrogance about it. Again, I've never heard anybody else make this claim, so don't tell anybody I said this, because I could get in trouble with the higher-ups. You're not supposed to criticize a guy, sorry. In any case, however we interpret it, since in our culture we don't believe that God's talked to us, except some people believe that. Some of them have run our country. But anyway, our contemporary understanding of that is, it occurred to him that there were some people who would get it. What's really going on here is he's sitting there going, well, what am I going to do now? And it's kind of like, well, I can sit around here, but what's the point of that? Have I done all this work just so that I can sit here and be in the bliss of nirvana for the rest of my life? That's nice, but I mean, really? Is that all there is? And he realizes, well, the thing to do is to help other people to get there. Because this is it. This is the ultimate. And I shouldn't be the only one to get this. This should be shared with the world. It's exactly what a 12-stepper gets. Oh, I'm sober. Great. Well, and of course, the 12-step literature puts it a little differently. They say the way for us to hold on to it is to give it away. I don't know if that was true for the Buddha too, but maybe. There's a beauty and an elegance to that too in the 12 steps, and it's one of the things that I see about the steps is that they trick you into doing things by telling you that it's for you, and they trick you into being of service by knowing that alcoholics are, concerned about themselves. So, oh, it's just for you. You need to help other people. No, don't worry, it's not for them. It's for you. You're doing this. So. There's an elegance to this step then, that this process that we awaken. It's not for us. It's not selfish. And this again come where the 12-step language and program and practice and path is not so explicitly but implicitly pointing to the same idea that Buddhism points us to, which is that there really isn't any separation between us. There really isn't an I here, a solid self. Everything's connected. When we only use our first name in meetings, when we say that anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, I don't think that what's the important element of that is that you don't tell people that you are in a program, or that you don't go on the radio and TV and say that you're in AA. What's spiritual about that is that when you walk into a meeting, you're dropping your identity. You're dropping all the trappings of your identity, except just a name that will help to keep track of you in the room. But you don't walk in the meeting as Joe, the guy who owns the car repair shop, and Susie, the plumber, you walk in there just as yourself. When I go to a meeting, I'm not Kevin Griffin, the guy who wrote One Breath at a Time. I'm Kevin. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. You know, that stuff goes out the door, because that's what's weighing us down, that identity. And it's freeing when we drop that and just move into a space as a being, as a being who's sharing beingness with others. So that's what this step, and that's what the Buddha's movement towards service is expressing, that understanding that the ways that we define ourselves and separate ourselves from others are the ways that we cause ourselves suffering, that awakened spirituality sees the connection, not the separation. And then the step concludes by saying, practice these principles in all our affairs, which to me is the loophole closer. In case you were wondering if there was some time when you didn't have to practice these principles, forget about it. This is it. This is about your whole life. This isn't about special times when you go to meetings or you go to meditation or you're in those identified, structured, ritualistic times of spirituality, but this is about living a life of spirituality, which is, as I said, the same thing the Buddha is saying with the Noble Eightfold Path. I mean, people tend to focus on, oh, mindfulness, that's the Buddha's path, and concentration, but it's also got right livelihood in there as part of the Eightfold Path. It doesn't say, that's a minor part of the Eightfold Path. It's right there, 1/8 of the path. It's your livelihood. The five precepts, another 1/8 of the path. Not to harm, not to steal, not to kill, not to use intoxicants, not to lie, not to harm people with our sexuality. The way we live is our spiritual path. Our spiritual path isn't something that's separate from our lives. People will say this, oh, I'm not very spiritual. That like they have to go somewhere to be spiritual. Well, take a breath. You're spiritual. What is that? That's what the word spirit comes from, right? To inspire, to breathe in, to breathe out. And finally, I'll say what I find intriguing about this step also is that it says these principles, but it doesn't exactly say what these principles are. And I think that's, again, something for us to contemplate. I was at a meeting in Delaware a few months ago. I guess it was over Thanksgiving. And they had a little handout, the principles of the program. So this is what that meeting, and I don't know where they got it, but this is what they say the principles of the program are. Step 1, honesty. Step 2, hope. Step 3, faith. Step 4, courage. Step 5, integrity. Step 6, willingness. Step 7, humility. Step 8, brotherly love. Step 9, justice. Step 10, perseverance. Step 11, spiritual awareness. Step 12, service. It's one list. You can make your own. So those are some thoughts on step 12. Got a few more minutes if there are any of your thoughts or questions or comments.
I'm armed and ready.
So nothing came up. That's great. It's really the power of my presence. that just causes emptiness to pervade all beings who come within a certain, and just whoosh, everything dissolves into oneness.
I particularly liked your insight about anonymity in 12-step meetings. Mm-hmm. I'd actually never thought of it that way. And
well, I just came up with that as a defense against the fact that I sort of break my anonymity in my books. So I had to figure out a way to rationalize that wasn't the really important part.
I think you're right on.
Oh,
you
yeah,
know?
I agree.
Because there's a, you know, you can go into a meeting or after a meeting and have there be a lot of debate about anonymity, no, whether yeah. it's on the radio, on the TV,
right.
Your personalities, blah, blah, mm-hmm. blah. And I think what you've said is much more poignant, much more to the point.
Yeah, it's a spiritual issue then. It isn't a political issue.
Exactly, yeah.
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 Hi.
Hi.
I'd just like to say thanks for this class and the series. It's been really awesome. And it's definitely helped me with my program and with my understanding of meditation in a very simple ways.
Good.
Because I jumped in the middle years and years ago and had a very hard experience meditating. So it's good to start the basics.
Yeah.
But the meditation today, I had a lot of release with crying and a lot of yawning. Mm-hmm. yawning. And I don't think I'm very tired. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking that my body or my inner self really want to awaken. And then when I do that really intense yawning, mm-hmm. I think that I heard somewhere along the way that the body or the soul wants to awaken.
Mm.
And and then that could just be my attachment to yawning. Yeah.
Right.
You know, I don't know. But I was wondering what your thoughts are on that.
On yawning?
Yeah. Is it just a false idea that I have? Because it was really intense, just yawn after yawn and crying and spinning out or going up. Something in my body was kind of doing this infinite eight, you know, like a lot more movement happening. But it could just be some attachment that I have, you know.
Yeah. Well, I guess as you're talking about, I'm remembering how sometimes if I'm crying and yawning seems like it's a way to stop crying. Usually if I yawn, sometimes that'll happen to me. I'll be crying and then I'll like yawn and it'll kind of like take the wind out of it in some way. And I'm not I don't know what the relationship is. Probably somebody's done research on that, you know, because they research everything. But generally, it just sounds like, I mean, one way of characterizing it is kind of energy being processed or, you know, karma being burnt off, kind of, which is sort of a risky phrase, but just that, you know, as emotions come up, they get expressed through the body.
Right.
And emotions, one of the qualities of emotions is that they have an energetic quality, and that energetic quality is kind of, I think, is what gets expressed in the body. So they can be, you know, they can be dullness, it can be elation, it can be tears, it can be yawning. It's just energy. And how do you feel now?
Good. Good. I had lots of different evolutions of process in that meditation.
Yeah.
And I also wanted to say thanks for last week for you to sit up there in your uncomfortableness.
Was I uncomfortable last week?
Yeah, you were sick.
Oh.
and it was hard. And then
oh, when I was feeling nauseous.
Yeah.
Was that last week?
Yeah.
See, I have really bad.
It goes by quick.
A couple weeks ago. Yeah.
And but I often feel very uncomfortable in my meditations.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it took me a while, like week, to reflect on that. But I wanted to thank you for sitting up there and teaching in that place.
Yeah.
And thank you so much for the class. Yeah. I really enjoy meditating with you.
Good. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you.
Me too.
I just wrote a quick blog this afternoon because there's a website or kind of a blog site called Improve Our Conscious Contact that I've been writing for a few years, and you can look it up. They have different writers every month, and I've been writing like once a year for the last few years, and I was supposed to write in April, and I just got an email a couple of days, oh, you were supposed to write something, and I was like, oh, right, yeah, right. And so I just wrote about trying to control our experience in meditation, because that's been something that's kind of been a theme in my teaching lately, and just that how, particularly that, and in reference to what we're talking about here, that we usually come to meditation with these expectations about what we're supposed to get out of it and what it's supposed to be like. And then if it doesn't live up to that expectation, we try to control it. Why do I feel, what can I do so that my back doesn't hurt when I'm meditating? What can I do so that I'm not sleepy when I'm meditating? What can I do so that I won't have so many thoughts when I'm meditating? Which is all about trying to control your experience. Rather than mindfulness saying, what's happening? Can I be present with it? Can I allow it? And sometimes it's pleasant and sometimes it's unpleasant. No. Kind of like life. Yeah.
I've been reading your writings and listening to you speak now in this last year of my adventure in sobriety with AA, and really feeling very, very, as if I'm growing and learning and very positive about that. Want to thank you. I really appreciate the growth that I've had in terms of my understanding of Buddhism and meditation and insight and becoming more mindful. And I'm very excited about this idea of the interconnectedness and looking at, you know, these similarities and the commonality that we all have and you know, the reflection on the 12 steps in comparison or in context or in conjunction with Buddhism. Mm-hmm. One of the problems that I have is that, and I'm sure this is me, but I want to put it out there, is that I sort of feel that I'm in your classes and readings and other, you know, 12-step Buddhism recovery, you know, environments. Mm-hmm. And I see this sort of willingness to do some interpretation and there's an understanding, and I go back into the AA world and I feel like that is separate, that, you know, there's this sort of rigidity that isn't able to look at sort of the flexibility of being able to bring any Buddhist perspective into that. And I wonder if you have any comments on that. I think I'm also looking for maybe a sponsor that might have more of the perspective of a Buddhist worldview or view of the steps also. And, you know, maybe this isn't the context to discuss that, but not necessarily a Buddhist AA group.
Yeah.
But there, you know, there seems to be sort of a division between AA and in what I see, and you know, I come here on Thursdays after going to an AA meeting on Wednesday, and there isn't interconnectedness. Mm-hmm. It seems to be a separation. And, I'm certain it's me and my views, but I was wondering if you had any comments.
Yeah. I guess what I would say is that AA or any program is made up of individuals, and there's no authority in the same way that there is here. I'm sitting up here as an authority and trying to have a context for things, and I have a certain expertise as well. Whereas, in AA, it's like the historical literature is kind of the only thing that's recognized as an authority. And then different people take on leadership roles and try to be authorities. And that can then start to create the impression, can create a culture in different meetings and in different areas, I suppose, that imply that that's what the program is and that's what the steps mean. So I like to think that, and I have had the experience of being in plenty of meetings where I felt that there was a real open-mindedness and exploration. I've heard people say some of the things that I say in meetings, but without referring to Buddhism, and there is that inherent tension that since we're not affiliated, the 12-step programs are not affiliated with any religion, to start to talk about Buddhism any more than to talk about Christianity is, technically speaking, off limits. I don't know if it's even technically speaking, but generally, as I understand it, that's considered off limits, and yet, of course, it's done at times. For myself, I've come to see that my program has a certain role for me, and one of the reasons that I started doing what I'm do is that it didn't fulfill all my needs from a spiritual viewpoint, but it fulfilled some of them. And there are some things I can get at a meeting that I can't get here. So I like knowing that there's all this stuff, and I consider myself very lucky that there are these different ways for me to do this work, that I can go on a Buddhist retreat or I can go to an AA meeting and many other things, of course. But I guess if I'm going to give advice, it would be don't worry too much about that. You know, don't try to force everybody to get along or to understand or agree with everything. Just go and, as they say, take what you need and leave the rest, and then go where you need to go to get what else you need. Don't expect the one place to take care of all your needs. It's like expecting one person to take care of all your needs, and we know what that does, those of us who are relationship addicts. So we seem to be out of time. And I, again, just to say that this has been, for me, a really enjoyable, and I kind of feel re-inspired teaching this course this year. There were a couple years ago where I decided not to teach it for a year, and then I took it up again, and because as I kind of, if not said directly, I've certainly alluded to the fact that I don't like repeating myself and kind of doing the same thing over and over, and doing the same class over and over is challenging for me, but I guess doing it once a year shouldn't be that hard. I'm such a whiner. But it's really been good working with all of you, and really what makes a class work is the people who come and their involvement. You know, it's another one of those kind of misunderstandings. It's like, oh, that teacher was so good. It's like, no, the group is good. You know, the group is good, and that makes the teacher better. Hopefully I was good. You know, but anyway, it makes me think I'll probably do this again next year. But in the meantime, I hope I will see you all at some other events, and I hope you will continue to practice these principles in all your affairs.
Please consider supporting Dharma Seed with a year-end gift. Your donations allow us to offer these teachings online to all. Visit dharmaseed.org/donate to learn more. And thanks.